Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Tuesday, January 2nd, 2024. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. K through 12 schools in Idaho could have funding cut by $162 million because state funding formula is based on attendance and not enrollment. The legislature failed to change that last year. Federal district judge partially denies Attorney General Raul Labrador's motion to totally dismiss lawsuit over Idaho abortion law. New Washington laws take effect. And Moscow Contemporary losing lease and must vacate the former Pritchard Art Gallery space on Main Street in downtown Moscow. We'll have a full interview with Moscow Contemporary director Roger Rowley. That's all coming up on the KRFP Evening Report, but first, world headlines from Feature Story News, the Pacifica Radio Network, and the Public News Service.
Hamas and Hezbollah officials say top Hamas official Saleh Arouri has been killed in an explosion in a southern Beirut suburb. Arouri, one of the founders of Hamas military wing, had headed the group's presence in the West Bank. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had threatened to kill him even before the Hamas-Israel war began on October 7th. Israeli officials declined to comment about the Tuesday evening blast.
In total, seven people were killed in the Lebanese capital. Hamas called the killings cowardly and accused Israel of violating Lebanon sovereignty and of spreading the conflict to the wider region.
The Israeli military has said it is pulling thousands of troops out of the Gaza Strip, even as fighting between Israeli forces and Hamas militants continues. The move over the next several weeks could set the stage for a long-term phase of lower-intensity fighting against Hamas. Julie Walker has that story.
While Israel says it's pulling the troops in the coming weeks for training and rest, additional defense forces will continue to bear down on other parts of the embattled territory, especially the south. Israel has been under pressure from the U.S. to switch to lower intensity fighting. But the country has pledged to charge ahead until its war aims have been achieved, including dismantling Hamas, saying it expects the war to go on for months. Israel says more than 8,000 militants have been killed. Gaza's health ministry says almost 22,000 people there have been killed, including women and children. I'm Julie Walker.
Israel's Supreme Court struck down a key component of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's contentious judicial overhaul yesterday. In the 8-7 majority decision, the court narrowly voted to overturn a law passed in July that prevents judges from overturning government decisions that they deem unreasonable. That reform would have essentially taken away from the Supreme Court the ability to review and limit the government's actions. Netanyahu and his cabinet, the most religious and politically conservative in Israel's history, claimed the court had become too powerful, vetoing government policies. Opponents of the legislation said it was an attack on democracy aimed at neutering the judicial system so that the government had nearly unfettered power. Monday's court decision could reignite those tensions, which sparked months of protests against the government and rattled the cohesion of the powerful military. Those divisions were largely put aside while the country focused on the war in Gaza.
Five people aboard a Japanese Coast Guard plane have died after it collided with a Japan Airlines passenger jetliner at Tokyo's Haneda Airport. All 379 people on the commercial aircraft were safely evacuated. Jeffrey Hall, special lecturer at Kanda University of International Studies in Tokyo, has been following the story.
As it was approaching the runway, it collided with a Japan Coast Guard airplane. This caused it to quickly catch fire, and this is causing a huge problem because this is one of the busiest airports and they have a burning wreck on their runway.
The Coast Guard plane was due to deliver aid to areas devastated by Monday's fatal earthquake, which killed dozens of residents in the west of the nation. Japan's Prime Minister says his country is in a race against time to rescue those still trapped beneath the rubble. Our correspondent there, Chris Gilbert, brings us the latest.
In an address the morning after the magnitude 7.6 quake struck, Prime Minister Fumio Kishida said 1,000 self-defense troops have been deployed to affected areas, but rescue efforts are being hampered by widespread damage to roads. Officials are still assessing the scale of the destruction. Japan's strongest earthquake since 2011 has caused fires and landslides and collapsed dozens of buildings. The country's meteorological agency has lifted all tsunami advisories, but says tidal waves could still turn. It's also warning that strong earthquakes could still occur, particularly over the next 2 to 3 days. Many people are still taking shelter in evacuation centres.
South Korea's opposition leader Lee Jae-myung has been stabbed in the neck during a visit to the city of Busan. Mr. Lee, who narrowly lost the 2022 presidential election, was airlifted to hospital, where doctors treated the wound that they say is not life-threatening. A suspect's been detained, though no motive declared.
Prominent pro-democracy activist and publisher Jimmy Lai has pleaded not guilty to 3 charges of sedition and collusion with foreign countries in a landmark national security trial in Hong Kong. Lai was arrested in a crackdown on dissidents following huge pro-democracy protests in 2019. He faces possible life imprisonment if convicted under a sweeping draconian national security law imposed by Beijing. The media tycoon, who founded the now defunct Apple Daily newspaper, faces one count of conspiring to print seditious publications to incite hatred against the Chinese and Hong Kong governments. He also was charged with collusion with foreign countries and calling for sanctions against China and Hong Kong. Officials in Ukraine say the country's 2 largest cities were struck by Russian ballistic missile attacks, with at least 5 people killed and nearly 100 injured. With the war approaching its 2-year mark, the Kremlin has stepped up its winter bombardment of Ukrainian cities. Karen Chamas has more.
Emergency workers were seen rescuing a person from the wreckage of a building in the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv after the city was struck by Russian missiles. In Kyiv, 5 areas of the city were hit in the strikes and at least 12 people were injured, according to Mayor Vitaly Klitschko. The governor of the Kharkiv region said at least 1 person died and dozens were injured in Russian missile strikes that hit the center of Kharkiv city and other areas. The barrage of the cities continued Russia's escalated attacks on Ukraine in recent days that began on Friday with its largest single attack since the war started. I'm Karen Chamas.
The Catholic Church in Hungary won't follow the Vatican's new rule allowing priests to bless same-sex unions. Church leaders have issued guidance to parishes in the country to avoid such blessings. Pablo Gutierrez reports from Budapest.
Tensions are growing between the Hungarian Catholic Church and the Vatican over same-sex blessings. The new guidance was issued in December and permits blessings, but not during regular church rituals. But Hungarian bishops have instructed priests not to bless same-sex couples. They say that such blessings contradict God's law and the teachings of the church. Bishops in more than 12 countries have openly rejected the new policy, refusing to allow same-sex blessings in their diocese. Pablo Gutierrez, Budapest.
A United Nations report says that more than 1,000 Burundian troops deployed in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo have been wearing uniforms of the Congolese army and fighting against the M23 rebels in the troubled region. Chris Okamrinja has more from Kinshasa.
The report by the UN group of experts says the Burundian troops were airlifted to the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo last year. It says they were deployed alongside Congolese forces to fight the M23 rebel group in North Kivu province. Congolese authorities declined to comment about the operations of the Burundian troops in their territory. The fighting in eastern DRC has caused a humanitarian crisis. More than 1 million people have been displaced since October last year. Chris Ochamringa, Kinshasa.
Denver police arrested a man early this morning after he allegedly shot out a window at the Colorado Supreme Court building and broke inside. Police have not publicly identified the suspect, but in a statement, Colorado State Patrol said that after crashing his car into another vehicle at around 1:15 a.m. and threatening the other driver with his gun, the man broke into the Ralph L. Carr Colorado Judicial Center, held a security guard at gunpoint, stole keys, and walked through the building while firing more shots before calling 911 and voluntarily turning himself in around 3 a.m. It's unclear what motivated the break-in, though police say it was not related to previous threats against the Colorado Supreme Court.
The FBI has launched an investigation after a car containing numerous gas canisters intentionally plowed into another vehicle and a crowd outside a New Year's Eve concert in upstate New York, killing 2 and wounding several more. Authorities say there are no indications of terrorism. Rochester Police Chief David Smith confirmed in a news briefing today that Michael Avery from Syracuse rented an SUV and bought up a stash of gasoline canisters in the days leading up to the attack. In the early hours of Monday morning, he then drove to the Kodak Center in Rochester and accelerated toward a crowd of people as they left a rock concert at the venue.
Jury selection has got underway in New York in the trial against Wayne LaPierre and three other members of the National Rifle Association. The NRA's longtime leader is accused of corruption and diverting the group's money to pay for lavish expenses. FSN's William Denslow reports from New York.
Last week, an appeals court rejected the National Rifle Association's efforts to have the lawsuit tossed. Now the suit filed by New York's Attorney General Letitia James, back in 2020, is set to begin on January 8th, after jury selection concludes. James is seeking to remove Wayne LaPierre as the NRA's chief executive and slap a range of financial penalties on the powerful gun rights group. LaPierre and several other NRA members are accused of decades of corruption and spending millions of dollars of the organization's funds on things like luxury travel. LaPierre says these were legitimate business expenses, and the NRA argues the case is politically motivated. William Denslow, New York.
Many new California state laws went into effect on New Year's Day, including the state's new concealed firearms restriction that until Saturday had been blocked by a federal judge. That law bans Californians from carrying guns in various public places such as parks, stadiums, and places of worship. Another new law includes a requirement that insurance companies negotiate and settle payments with ambulance companies for out-of-network charges and limits ambulance bills for uninsured people to the Medi-Cal or Medicare rate. Another ups the penalty for dealing fentanyl in the state, adding 3 years to the sentence for dealing more than 1 kilogram of fentanyl. And another expands medical benefits to all adults in the state who qualify regardless of immigration status.
Kentucky lawmakers convene this week for the 2024 legislative session, and a new report finds state representatives are increasingly fast-tracking legislation while eroding citizen participation. The League of Women Voters of Kentucky analysis finds lawmakers are replacing original versions of bills with last-minute substitute versions, leaving little or no time for citizens to review or comment before a committee vote. Janie Lindell with the League says the tactic often guts the original language of a bill and hijacks it for a completely different purpose.
What we really saw was starting in 2002, but especially escalating from 2014 to 2022. There have been just this increasing rush on certain bills that do become law and people can't participate.
House Bill 10, passed in 2022, eliminated the sharing of pre-filed bills on the Legislative Research Commission's website, meaning citizens can no longer preview pending legislation and subsequently have less time to consider or participate in discussions on the bill during the months before the session starts. According to the report, last year, 32% of bills that passed the Kentucky House and 24% that passed the Senate were fast-tracked in ways that cut out the public's voice. There's also been an increase in lawmakers holding full House or Senate floor votes the day bills get committee approval, shrinking the amount of time even the most engaged citizens have to contact their legislators, in some cases down to a few hours. Lindell says Kentuckians have the right to have time to fully understand the text of a bill and voice their opinion on it.
Citizens deserve to participate in anything that affects them. So the deliberation of legislation that's going to affect us, it's part of the democratic principle that if you're going to be affected by it, you get to have a voice in it.
Lindell says advocates want the General Assembly to take steps to strengthen opportunities for citizen participation, including by ensuring there are 3 bill readings after committee hearings, making substitute bills available online in advance of a committee meeting, and allowing at least 1 day between final action or floor votes on bills. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Kentucky News Connection.
Voting is not only good for democracy, it's also good for your health, according to one of the nation's largest medical associations. The American College of Physicians says voting empowers people to engage with their community, while ballot initiatives and elected officials determine just how well the healthcare system works. So ACP President Omar Atik says voters ultimately determine people's access to healthcare services and physicians' ability to treat them.
If there is more voter participation, there would be better healthcare policies and therefore better healthcare.
Atik says research shows states with fewer barriers to voting have better health outcomes than states with restrictive voting laws or gerrymandered maps. Massachusetts ranks 12th in the nation for ease of access to the ballot. The ACP is encouraging all healthcare professionals and medical students to engage patients in nonpartisan healthcare-related conversations about voting as a way to increase health equity. Atik says even posting voter registration information in patient waiting rooms is a good place to start.
We are looking at talking to patients about the importance of their voice in making sure that the national resources are allocated to where we have optimal health for everyone.
Atik says despite being one of the richest and most technically advanced nations in the world, the U.S. ranks lowest in life expectancy for both men and women among comparable countries. He says physicians have a responsibility to help their patients when they need it, and talking about voting on issues that improve health care is part of that help. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Commonwealth News Service, I'm Catherine Carley.
A new survey of the nation's small business owners shows a major challenge to successful operations is trying to provide health care for their employees. The Small Business for America's Future polled more than 1,000 small business owners, including 110 in Texas. Co-chair Dr. Erica Gonzalez says 74% said they weren't in a position to offer employees health insurance, which she says puts them at a disadvantage to hire or retain top talent.
If you're not able to offer that, a lot of employees are going to pass. Even if it's a good opportunity, they're going to pass on it if it means that they can get better coverage and security for their families elsewhere.
The survey revealed a bipartisan concern and consensus about the issue, with a nearly equal representation of Republican, Democratic, and independent small business owners. Gonzalez says respondents support regulating anti-competitive practices and boosting price transparency in billing in order to bring down the costs. Recent legislation passed by Texas lawmakers could open up the healthcare marketplace by eliminating anti-competitive clauses in health insurance contracts. Gonzalez says that's a step in the right direction, but more is needed.
They're also looking at legislation that would help with the facility fees that sometimes are added on by hospitals. And all of this would reflect back on knowing why they're paying for what they're paying and giving them transparency as to the bills that they're getting.
She admits that the healthcare challenge won't be solved overnight, but changes need to be implemented to determine if they improve the overall system in 2 to 3 years. The Small Business for America's Future survey found that annual premiums for employer-sponsored family health coverage was nearly $24,000 in 2023. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
Voting rights organizers say people across the South are facing a new wave of voter suppression tactics. Alabama Values, Solve, and the Groundwork Project recently brought groups together to cover these obstacles and ways to stay informed. In a webinar dubbed "The South's Got Something to Say," organizers from 5 states discussed the ongoing fight for fair maps and equitable representation after the case Alabama versus Milligan. Zephyr Scalzetti with the group Alabama Values says now that the state has secured new maps, it's crucial that voters stay informed, especially ahead of the primary election for District 2.
This is a new seat. There is no incumbent, and your vote really matters in elections like these, especially in the primary, because in Alabama and across the nation, we tend to focus on November as the day to turn out to vote. But in reality, the primary date is sometimes more important.
Scalzetti also points out voter registration data may not align with the correct congressional district just yet, as the state is in the process of manually reassigning voters. However, efforts are being made to address this issue, as Secretary of State Wes Allen has secured funding to extend geographic information system services to all counties in Alabama. Scalzetti says challenges persist in achieving equitable voting rights. He's concerned about a recent 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruling that private individuals and groups who historically filed lawsuits under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act no longer have the right to sue. While this only applies to 7 states, he said this could weaken Section 2 protections.
What I'm concerned about is not only that we see this tactic happen in other circuit courts, but now we have a fundamental disagreement between 2 circuit courts, and that's prime ground for the Supreme Court to step in and say, well, as the supreme law of the land, we need to talk about which circuit court decision is correct. And that's worrisome.
Not limited to Alabama, organizers in Louisiana, Georgia, South Carolina, and other states are voicing concerns about misinformation surrounding voting rights for people who have served time, non-native English speakers, and even the potential impact of artificial intelligence. And they stress the importance of maintaining momentum in voting education, advocacy, and community building in 2024. For Alabama News Service, I'm Shantia Hudson.
In 2024 and beyond, Wisconsin could see big changes related to voting. New political boundaries are expected based on a state Supreme Court ruling, while some pro-democracy organizers hope for a different way of choosing candidates. Last week's court decision resulted in current legislative maps drawn up by Republicans being tossed out over arguments they were unconstitutional. Researchers have long noted that Wisconsin has some of the most gerrymandered maps in the country. Bob Moline with the Western Wisconsin group Grow Action says he's happy with the outcome. He hopes the state takes things a step further by adopting Final Five voting.
It reduces the incentives that create those toxic, hate-filled campaign ads. It reduces the incentives that reward gridlock and extremism in our elections today.
The process essentially creates a nonpartisan primary, with the top five vote-getters moving on to the general election. In that second step, a ranked-choice-style system would be used. A bill in Wisconsin to switch to Final Five has bipartisan support, but Moline says it may take several legislative sessions to see a vote. Analysts say a potential setback under this approach is voters not being able to discern between moderate and extreme candidates. As for redistricting changes, Moline says it wouldn't be surprising to see Republicans appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. But he says he's still hopeful Wisconsin voters will soon get a chance to cast their ballots under updated boundaries.
This is the best chance we have for truly fair maps, and it's the right process.
Moline has been part of past grassroots campaigns that called for an independent redistricting commission in Wisconsin. Policymakers have a couple of weeks to submit new maps that will be reviewed by court-appointed consultants. Republican leaders have insisted their methods in creating the maps were fair and legal. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
The Grand Canyon State's top election official is testing open-access artificial intelligence tools in preparation for a potential wave of disinformation during next year's election. Arizona's Democratic Secretary of State Adrian Fontes recently held a first-of-its-kind simulation in which he presented participants with AI-generated audio and video of officials, including himself, spreading falsehoods. Fontes says the exercise is intended to increase readiness and resilience in the battleground state.
So that we can have a live exercise where election officials can, in real time, react to scenarios that get thrown at them. So it's really about training, preparation.
Fontes says mis, dis, and malinformation remain a primary threat to the security of elections, with advances in AI and deepfake technology heightening the potential for chaos. A recent UChicago-Harris AP-NORC poll found a bipartisan majority of adults are worried about the spread of falsehoods during the 2024 election. Fontes argues he'd like to see election administrators across the country have access to a centralized space where they can look to get the most updated and current election-related information. He also would like election officials to participate in continuing education initiatives, such as those many other professionals have to partake in, to be able to continue in their positions.
Just like attorneys have an attorney do with continuing legal education, our election officials can have this reference space where they can go learn more, figure more out, and then continue to up their own game.
Fontes calls elections critical infrastructure that should be conceptualized like roads, bridges, dams, and water systems, all crucial for communities to thrive. He argues that elections need to be better cared for and funded at the state and federal level. For Arizona News Connection, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
Petitions are being circulated for a potential ballot question in North Dakota that calls for the state to go back to counting votes by hand during elections. Administrators are not embracing the idea. Several provisions are being floated under the Election Integrity Act initiative, and moving away from electronic machines for processing ballots is among them. Supporters contend that fixes are needed because they feel the people have lost faith in elections. But Pierce County Auditor Karen Migler says the machines have proven to be effective in tabulating votes. She suggests the proposed change would be too risky compared to current methods.
Human error is possible. You'd have to probably count 2-3 times to come out with the same number.
For a small staff like hers, Migler says they would be counting after a long day and that results would be delayed. She says that could open the door to other criticism when it comes to election transparency. Backers of the idea acknowledge the likelihood of delays while arguing North Dakota could become a leader if the proposal advances. It's unclear if the petition drive will receive enough signatures to appear on the 2024 ballot. Migler says those who are skeptical of electronic machines can always get a first-hand look to see how they operate.
We do check them beforehand, and it's a public test, so anybody can watch if they wish. We have so many ballots, and then we have the results, what they should be, and the machines are right on.
Petition organizers have until February 12th to turn in enough signatures to get the issue on the primary ballot in 2024. Other provisions in the proposal include eliminating early voting and placing limitations on voting absentee. This is Mike Moen for Prairie News Service.
An analysis of big banks in New York City finds they're perpetuating lending disparities. The New Economy Project report finds banks aren't lending to people of color at the same rate they're lending to others. The report notes these banks originated 25 cents in mortgage loans in neighborhoods of color for every dollar they lent in all other neighborhoods, although New York City neighborhoods of color are about equal to all others. Will Spisak with the New Economy Project says this isn't a new issue.
We see this predictable, unfortunately, pattern that's played out throughout history and continues to today of whiter communities getting more investment, more services, and better attention from the banking sector, and black and brown communities continuing to deal with the legacy and continued practice of redlining.
Banking agencies are working to keep banks in check. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau recently accused Wells Fargo of discrimination in mortgage loans. The CFPB found black and female borrowers got fewer pricing exceptions than other customers. While Wells Fargo has faced reprimands for this, Spisak feels more could be done, such as New York City refusing to keep city funds in that bank. The report says one solution to provide loans to those who need them is creating a public bank. City and state-level legislation has been brought forward, and although it has gained some support, it has yet to be passed. Spisak says studies about public banking in New York prove this could be beneficial to city and state residents.
We could get about 18,000 affordable housing units built through a public bank in the first 5 years. It would create 70,000 plus jobs. We would get about $6 billion went into neighborhoods of color and lower income communities within the first 5 years.
After several banking institutions were seized by the federal government in 2023, advocates like Spisak feel a public bank would help protect New York's financial assets. He notes since these are newer bills, they're still garnering support. This is Edwin J. Vieira for New York News Connection.
Coloradans who graduate from college or trade schools are ready to join the labor market equipped with high-demand, highly competitive skills needed to thrive in their chosen career path, according to the Colorado Department of Higher Education's latest Return on Investment report. Dr. Angie Piccioni directs the agency and says there are significant benefits to getting any education or training beyond high school.
When you attain higher education, you get higher earnings, better health outcomes, you get less unemployment. Typically, debt goes down.
9 out of 10 employers in the state say they have jobs to fill but can't find skilled workers. Colorado ranks second nationally with more than 60% of its residents with some post-secondary education, including large numbers of people who moved to the state with a degree in hand. But just 25% of black adults have a degree or credential, according to Justice for Black Coloradans. Piccioni points to the success of the Colorado Opportunity Scholarship Initiative, which has shown that it's possible to bridge that attainment gap, but she says more funding is needed to scale up and reach more students.
It was designed for low-income students, first-generation students, and students of color to get both the scholarships and the wraparound support services. These students will change the trajectory of their families and of themselves, of course.
Each new post-secondary graduate in Colorado contributes more than $132,000 to the state's GDP. Colorado workers without a degree or credential earn on average less than $1,000 per week, compared with $1,500 per week for those with bachelor's degrees and more than $2,000 per week for those with advanced degrees. Piccioni says the state has taken steps to remove cost as a barrier.
We have about 12 occupations that students in Colorado can pursue at zero cost for tuition and fees. The construction trades, firefighting, elementary and early childhood education, forest management, certified nursing assistant.
Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. This is Eric Galatis for the Colorado News Connection.
A new study calls the economic and social changes brought about by the Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska over the past 3 decades a story of numerous achievements. Ho-Chunk Inc. sponsored the report by consulting economist Jonathan Taylor. Taylor's observations include the doubling of the tribe's middle class over the last 30 years. He attributes this to their multiple institutions, with about 3,500 jobs in Nebraska, South Dakota, and Iowa in 2022, and a combined payroll of nearly $200 million.
And that surprise change is really what American Indian Economic Development has been endeavoring to achieve across the country. And this is in a remote plains tribe in the poorest county of Nebraska.
Among the tribe's entities are its oldest and largest, Ho-Chunk Inc., as well as several for-profit and non-profit institutions, including a college, a hospital, and a community development corporation. Taylor also found an issue needing attention. 1/3 of the tribe's children are growing up in poverty. However, the proportion of members living below the federal poverty line has shrunk from 1/2 to 1/3. Taylor notes the number of tribal members with college degrees and skills training has effectively quadrupled in the past 20 years. He says the tribe's ability to thrive gained momentum with its steps to diversify from the gaming industry back in the 1990s.
And the multitude of these institutions, their different capacities, their different specializations, their different ability to raise money or bring money in as revenue from sales to customer really explains a lot of their success.
Lance Morgan, founder and CEO of Ho-Chunk Inc., the tribe's economic development corporation, calls the tribe's multi-institutional approach key to its success. He says failing to do this is one reason poverty is intractable on many reservations.
Unless you unleash the natural abilities of tribal people through these institutions, you never go anywhere. We have been really focused on this development of institutions and people across the board. And what's happening is that natural organic growth is happening.
Morgan says the success of their institutions has also brought about changes in the tribal council's role.
All the tribe has to do is sort of set the table and set policy, which is kind of what the government does in the United States. And all of the growth used to happen from the council down, and that never really worked because you have an unstable body with varying skill sets that change from year to year.
Morgan says their population has grown by 30% in the last 8 years. For Nebraska News Connection, I'm Deborah Van Fleet.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Nick Harper.
In Washington, I'm Benji Hire.
In London, I'm Simon Gaitan.
I'm Max Pringle.
I'm Scott Baba.
KRFP, Moscow Pullman.
And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Although the Idaho legislature approved a $415 million increase in K-12 education funding during a special session in September 22, which caused Reclaim Idaho to withdraw its popular quality education initiative that year, Governor Brad Little's decision to allow the state's education funding formula to return to being based on attendance rather than the pandemic-era funding formula based on enrollment may cost schools a major chunk of that, about $162 million, according to the Idaho Education News. Governor Little vetoed a bill in 2022 that would have allowed the enrollment-based funding formula to continue into the current fiscal year. Most of the state's 190 school districts and charter schools will lose money because of the reversion to the former policy. Idaho School Board Association Government Affairs Director Quinn Perry told the Idaho Education News, "We knew and made our best attempts to warn state leaders that shifting back to attendance would bring a dramatic drop in how state funding is distributed, but it's quite distressing to see the difference." About 50, mostly smaller, school districts and charter schools will benefit from the attendance-based funding formula. State Superintendent of Public Instruction Debbie Critchfield underestimated the funding gap from returning to the attendance-based formula and asked for $92 million more in her funding request this fall to account for the difference. Critchfield has recently stated she has a more comprehensive understanding of school attendance data and will continue discussions on next steps with the governor's office and others. Governor Brad Little is set to make his budget request public in his State of the State address next Monday. Little's communications director, Emily Callahan, told the Idaho Education News last week the governor's staff is examining attendance data and, quote, will make a budget recommendation in January that takes the trend line into account. Callahan noted the Idaho legislature has recently made historic investments in K-12 schools, and the total public school budget this fiscal year is $2.7 billion, which is a 16% increase over previous years. Callahan said this included record investments in teacher pay and benefits, classified staff pay, and discretionary dollars to meet local needs. Fourth District Judge Jason Scott on Friday partially granted Attorney General Raul Labrador's motion to dismiss Adkins versus Idaho, filed by four women who want the state to allow abortions during medically complex pregnancies that threaten their health. Last month, the Attorney General's office asked the court to dismiss the lawsuit, saying Idaho's policy is to allow no exception for abortions in situations where the physician believes the fetus is unlikely to survive after birth. Physicians are facing felony charges and up to 5 years in jail if they choose to perform an abortion on the wrong side of the law that does not allow abortions that could help save the pregnant woman's health. The Center for Reproductive Rights filed the lawsuit on behalf of the four women, two Idaho physicians, and the Idaho Academy of Family Physicians. The Idaho Capital Sun reports Judge Scott allowed the part of the lawsuit to continue that asks for a declaratory judgment on whether physicians may, quote, provide a pregnant person with abortion care when the physician determines in their good faith judgment and in consultation with the pregnant person that the pregnant person has an emergency medical condition that poses a risk of death or a risk to their health. The decision also keeps the part of the lawsuit alive that asks for a declaratory judgment on the medical circumstances in which a physician may perform an abortion. Judge Scott's decision also allows part of the lawsuit to move forward with a motion for a declaratory judgment on whether the Idaho Constitution's recognition of, quote, enjoying and defending life, unquote, and, quote, pursuing happiness and securing safety, unquote, as inalienable rights entitles women to have abortion care in emergency situations. The lawsuit is different from a lawsuit over Idaho's abortion ban before the state Supreme Court because it does not seek the wholesale invalidation of Idaho's abortion laws, but instead whether they violate the state constitution in a subset of situations. Scott dismissed part of the lawsuit that asked whether Idaho's abortion laws violate the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution and due process. He also dismissed Governor Brad Little, the Board of Medicine, the Attorney General as defendants, leaving just the state of Idaho as the defendant. The next court date in the case is October 24th of this year. The Idaho Education News has published interviews with people who wrote to the State Board of Education and University of Idaho officials during the 2 days in May between the time the UI announced it was planning to purchase the 75,000-student online University of Phoenix and when the State Board of Education approved the financing plan for the purchase. The Idaho Education News reports the more than two dozen emails were as close as the public got to a public hearing on the issue. The State Board of Education did not take public comment at its May 18th meeting when it approved the deal. Tenured University of Idaho sociology professor Leontina Hormel indicated she is skeptical of the University of Idaho's statement on its frequently asked questions page, which said the purchase of the University of Phoenix would not have a significant impact on university employees. Hormel believes if the purchase goes through, the University of Idaho will shift general education courses to the University of Phoenix so the classes can be offered at a lower cost. Hormel told the Idaho Education News, "We've been told repeatedly that this is not going to have a negative consequence on business here, that it'll just be business as usual on campus, but I find that very difficult to believe." She called the possible future shift a version of outsourcing. University of Idaho graduate Scott Fehrenbacher, who is now Vancouver, BC Habitat for Humanity CEO and who was Associated Student Body President while going to school at the UI, wrote a letter to UI President C. Scott Green saying he believes the University of Phoenix deal will hurt the university and its reputation. Although President Green says the purchase of the University of Phoenix will help protect the school from the expected nationwide enrollment cliff as fewer 18 to 22-year-olds head to college, Fehrenbacher says the purchase will cheapen the University of Idaho's brand at that crucial time. Fehrenbacher was an administrator at the for-profit Grand Canyon University in Arizona for 7 years. He said the University of Phoenix has an infrastructure that is not state-of-the-art. He said, "This is the dollar store of higher education, and I think the University of Idaho's students, parents, alumni, and donors deserve a lot better." Former White House and congressional staffer David Halperin, who as an attorney works on for-profit university issues, said, "It makes it look like to me that the University of Idaho and the State Board of Education are the most gullible in the nation." Halperin said the UI is downplaying the risk from the University of Phoenix's student loan write-offs, which could be between $1.5 million and $7 million per year, although the University of Idaho's financial plan for the purchase requires the University of Phoenix to transfer $200 million to a new nonprofit the UI would run in part to guard against such a liability. He noted the Biden administration's more aggressive stance against for-profit universities. For example, in September, the administration wrote off $37 million in debts to 1,200 University of Phoenix students, and separately in August wrote off $72 million in other student debts. The Idaho Department of Labor says the median household income has grown in the state 15% since a Census Department survey that covered the 5 years between 2013 and 2017. The statewide median household income was $70,200 in the 2018 through 2022 survey, which is a $9,153 increase over the previous survey. That's fifth in the nation in terms of dollars, but first in the nation in percentage. The Daily News reports the Labor Department says part of the reason is the state's rapid population growth during the COVID pandemic. A press release from the Labor Department said the need for entry-level service workers exceeded the supply of willing employees, boosting wages in sectors like health care and social assistance, accommodations and food service, and education. The pandemic also increased demand for construction workers due to the housing boom. Median household income increased 20% in Latah County between the five-year period between 2013 and 2017 and the five-year period between 2018 and 2022. During the latter period, the median income in the county was $62,258, up $10,390 from the previous five-year period. Nez Perce County's median income was $65,000 during the most recent five-year period, but it increased only 5% since the previous five-year period. Some lawmakers are already arriving in Boise for the 2024 legislative session, which is set to begin Monday, January 8th. On Thursday and Friday this week, the Idaho Legislature's Economic Outlook and Revenue Assessment Committee will meet at the state capitol. Governor Brad Little will give the annual State of the State address to a joint meeting of the legislature's two chambers next Monday, and the same day, the powerful Joint Finance Appropriations Committee will hold its first meeting of the year at the capitol. Lawmakers will undergo respectful workplace training at the capitol on Wednesday, January 10th. You're tuned into the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP is supported by listeners like you and Rembrandt Tree Care, family owned and operated since 1977. A conscientious approach to urban forestry with year-round tree service on the Palouse and surrounding areas. You can reach Rembrandt Tree Care at 509-330-0699.
KRFP thanks all of its donors and underwriters for helping make this programming possible.
With the 2024 legislative session around the corner, Washington State Adjunct College faculty hope they will be a priority for lawmakers. Adjunct faculty teachers at the state's higher education institutions are often paid far below their full-time faculty counterparts. Kate Modick is adjunct professor at Highline College and says she and her colleagues struggle to get by.
We have no real job security. We have contracts from quarter to quarter, and we really rely on the numbers of students enrolling or if full-time faculty get their full load. If they don't get the full load, our classes can be canceled. So there's a lot of job insecurity.
Modick says most adjunct faculty don't have offices, which makes it hard to meet with students. They also usually work at multiple colleges. The Washington Education Association is calling for pay parity for adjunct professors during the upcoming legislative session. Modick says to start, adjuncts want at least 85% pay parity with full-time faculty.
We need to be paid better right now across the state of Washington. So I think that's why we're really focusing on pay parity. We need the Band-Aid, and we're not even getting that.
Toby Rosenberg is an adjunct professor at Bellevue College. She says adjuncts are overused and colleges are understaffed, which hurts student success.
It has a huge impact on students. I see this as the gig economy of higher education. We're the Uber drivers here.
The legislative session begins on January 8th. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Bureau of Land Management wildlife biologist Carrie Hugo has counted a record number of bald eagles along a 12-mile stretch of Lake Coeur d'Alene shore. The BLM has been counting eagles around Wolf Lodge Bay on the lake's northeastern arm for nearly 50 years. Hugo has counted 409 bald eagles, consisting of 363 adults and 46 juveniles. She admits the counts are not precise because she may count some eagles twice if they fly ahead of her car as she makes her way around the route. The Spokesman Review reports bald eagles who congregate on Lake Coeur d'Alene in November and December each year usually migrate from British Columbia after lakes freeze there. They are after kokanee. Hugo told the paper, "It's a really good year for kokanee. I have never seen so many washed up on the shoreline." Biologists say kokanee come in boom and bust cycles. Idaho Fish and Game Regional Fisheries Manager Andy Ducks said, "There have been fewer kokanee at Lake Ponderay this year, so more eagles have been coming to Lake Coeur d'Alene." Ducks said the number of bald eagles usually peaks in mid-December, and by mid-January, there's usually hardly any left as the birds begin competing with each other for declining prey.
It's January, and organizations are calling for donations during Blood Donor Month, a designation first proclaimed in 1970. Diane Wright is the regional executive director for the American Red Cross of Montana, which also covers the organization's actions in Idaho. She says January is an important time for donations.
January was chosen because it's typically a challenging time of the year for us to collect life-saving blood, usually due to holiday seasons and the start of the new year and winter weather. It makes for a challenging time to collect.
About 3% of Americans donate blood each year. Each donation helps two or more people in need. Wright says donations are critical because blood can't be manufactured.
In Idaho, we need to collect about 250 units per weekday, and that's a significant amount of blood, and it's to save lives.
Blood donations help a wide range of people, including folks with cancer, who have been in accidents, or need emergency surgery. A blood transfusion is performed every 2 seconds in the United States. For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Wyoming won the largest grant in the nation, $24 million, in a federal pilot program aiming to reduce wildlife vehicle collisions and protect migration corridors. The Wyoming Game and Fish Department estimates that some 80 deer or antelope are killed by vehicles each year along a section of Highway 189 south of Kemmerer. Josh Corsi with the Muley Fanatics Foundation says this is also a motorist safety issue.
This particular stretch of highway has always been troublesome for motorists to travel, as it sits directly in the heart of a winter range for a mule deer and pronghorn herd.
Each year, 6,000 vehicle big game collisions are reported in Wyoming, resulting in up to $23 million in wildlife losses and nearly $30 million in personal injury costs. The grant comes from the U.S. Department of Transportation's initial investment of nearly $110 million to reduce collisions. The total cost of the Highway 189 project is expected to be $37 million, a price tag that includes up to six wildlife underpasses and one overpass on a section of road scientists and state officials have identified as the most in need of protections.
It's about a 30-mile stretch of roadway that will also include exclusionary fencing, which will help funnel, if you will, these critters to these appropriate underpasses and overpass so that they can cross this roadway as they continue to seek out their food.
Corsi says he expects Wyoming will become the poster child for the pilot program because the plan will be successful on day one. He says the state put itself in the driver's seat to win this funding after years of work by state game managers, scientists, and conservation groups, along with the solid commitment of lawmakers.
Through satellite collaring of critters and their migration movements, has really been able to pinpoint and identify where these need to be and know that they'll be in a place that works right out of the gate.
This is Eric Galatas for the Wyoming News Service.
Going into a big election year, staffing at elections offices in Oregon is an issue, according to a study. Staff-to-voter ratios vary widely between counties, depending on their size, but average about one staff member per 27,000 voters statewide. Paul Manson with Portland State University helped conduct the research and says there are warning signs flashing as this election year ramps up. He says it's a challenge for election offices to find workers in this politically charged environment.
That came up in our interviews where one out of five clerks, we actually had to stop the interviews because it became so difficult for them to talk about what they're hearing from members of the public and a sense of sort of attack and threats towards their offices to the point where some aren't comfortable even sharing what they do for a living outside of work.
Manson says low pay also makes it hard to recruit and retain people to work in elections offices. He says the county-level funding model, which is tied to the real estate market, presents challenges as well. Manson says these pressures have led election officials to leave the profession.
It's clearly institutional knowledge that's going to be walking out the door, and it's going to be another contentious presidential election cycle where we're going to need to be super sharp and transparent about this work for keeping public trust.
Manson says another pressure on workers is a growing list of public records requests, which officials have deadlines to respond to. He says there are a few ways the state could help election staff.
It might be creating a state public records request clearinghouse or a training position that helps support these counties in doing that training. So that's a real quick and immediate piece that I think would take a load off of clerk's shoulders. Longer term, reevaluating how funding happens for these offices is also critical.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A number of new laws have taken effect in Washington with the new year. There is a new 10-day waiting period for those wanting to buy a gun, and during those 10 days, the purchaser will have to pass a background check. The Washington State Standard reports another new Washington law required hospitals to establish staffing committees made up of nurses and administrators by the beginning of this year. The state will require the committees to approve staffing plans every year, which include nurse-to-patient ratios. The first plans are due by the end of 2024, and starting in 2027, the state can impose fines if the hospitals do not approve plans at least 80% of the time. Another new law blocks employers from requiring drug tests for cannabis as a condition of employment. Employers can still require tests for other drugs before hiring and can test for cannabis in blood in certain situations, such as after an accident, if they are suspicious a worker is impaired while on the clock, or to maintain a drug and alcohol-free workplace. The nonprofit art gallery Moscow Contemporary has lost its lease on the space at 5th and South Main Streets in downtown Moscow that has been an art gallery for nearly 40 years. The last day the art gallery was open was Saturday. Moscow Contemporary director Roger Rowley formed a nonprofit after the University of Idaho decided not to renew his contract as head of the UI's Pritchard Art Gallery in 2020. Moscow Contemporary continued to operate under Rowley's curation at 5th and Main Street rent-free since then, with the plan to eventually purchase the building from the current owner, Root Forest LLC. That fell through, and the owner is selling the building in February, with the unknown purchaser apparently having a condition that there be no tenant. Moscow Contemporary has canceled a prison art exhibit they planned to install in January in cooperation with the University of Idaho, and they must vacate the space by January 31st. The last exhibit involved photographs, writings, and poetry from widely published photographer and writer Marcus Jackson. Jackson's photographs show the starkness and vibrancy of life in New York City and Columbus, Ohio, during the time of the George Floyd protests and COVID at its most contagious in 2020 and 2021. Moscow Contemporary had its first artist in residence in 2022 with Venezuelan Elvis Rosendo, who has had exhibitions around the world. When Rosendo's exhibit opened in 2023, it included a wraparound film by Rosendo's son that required three projectors and involved characters and action filmed in a South American city that had been destroyed by a flood. Besides acting as a gallery, Moscow Contemporary had studio space for several art programs, some of which will continue at other locations. The gallery also provided space for Bands Off Our Bodies protesters to make signs and banners. Moscow Contemporary sent out a press release Friday saying they are looking for a new home. The press release touted Moscow Contemporary's growth. It says the average development time for a major exhibit is 3 to 5 years, with some taking as long as 10 years. Incredibly, we have created important exhibits and developed partnerships with a lead time of just months. The press release also touted the nonprofit's after-school arts program with 245 class slots in 2022, which increased to 804 slots in 2023. The press release also touted new programs such as the Collage Club, Animal Dances, the No School Art Program, and the Tiny Art Gallery. The release says Moscow Contemporary summer camps and adult workshops have grown. Moscow Contemporary has already decided to move the after-school art program and animal dances to the 1912 Center starting in the new year. The release said, "Does this sudden disruption impact Moscow Contemporary's potential to bring significant investments to the community?" Absolutely. During an interview with Moscow Contemporary director Roger Rowley Saturday afternoon at the gallery during the last scheduled hour of operation at 414 South Main, Rowley spoke about the negotiation process with building owner Rootstock LLC and said there may have been some opposition to the type of gallery he was curating, which led to the loss of gallery space. Here is that entire interview with Roger Rowley recorded Saturday.
First question. So we're with Roger Rowley, director of Moscow Contemporary Gallery in downtown Moscow. And we can talk a little bit more later about all the programs and, you know, all the wonderful things that the Moscow Contemporary does. But I sort of want to go talk a little bit just about, you know, what happened with the lease. I understand you had the place rent free, and the owner of the building also may have bought the building in part because they wanted to keep the Pritchard Gallery here, and they gave the university a reduced rate, is also what I've heard. So tell me about the negotiations. I heard there was like negotiations when the lease was up in August.
Yeah, we've been negotiating for a while in terms of what an extension of our existing lease might look like. Just to build on some of the facts that you were stating up front, the owners did buy the building from Leon Neuenschwander back in 2003, specifically to keep it as a gallery. And so for the years that the university leased the building from them, it probably was 75% of market rate. So slightly reduced for this space. And so the UI lease went through December 31st of 2023. But the university went through its budget cut positions, including the two that...
You mean 2020, right?
2020. Well, 2020 to 2021 is when they were eliminating positions.
Right.
So that's when my position went away and the assistant director's position went away. So in that period of trying to save the Pritchard, I created the idea of a nonprofit to operate in connection with the university. And at a certain point, it became clear that they had no interest in a partnership. Well, we'd already started this idea of a nonprofit. Right. And at a certain point, came to the conclusion that we could make this work without the university. But it did require help. And the building owners were incredibly supportive. Mm-hmm. They wanted to see a gallery continue. And that's what we were essentially offering to do, was to work collaboratively to keep a gallery here on Main Street.
We were given the
space for the same time period that the university had their lease. Mm-hmm. And then additionally, they gave us, the university bought its way out of their existing lease. Mm-hmm. And the building owners essentially signed that check over to us. So Yes, incredible generosity along with other donations that helped us get off the ground. There were also community members from the very get-go writing five-digit checks to us to keep it going, to get us started.
Right. So the owner is Root Forest LLC. Yes. Is that Brenda Von Wandruska?
Yes, it is. Her husband and Rob Davis.
Okay.
And they've done a number of things around town. So that they've collaborated together for years on projects in town.
Okay. And so when they decided that they wanted to have rent from you, they wanted market rate.
That was certainly one of the proposals. The very first offer to us was to continue rent-free for 1 year. And I've always been upfront that our intention was to get to the place where we could buy the building. To get to that point was going to take years. Mm-hmm. I always called it our 10-year plan. And so within that, it was the notion that if we're bleeding rent money, we can't get to the point of being able to actually afford to buy the building. If they'll support us through that period where we're building and then creating a capital campaign to buy the building, then we buy the building. We weren't asking them to donate the building. We were not asking them to do something that would, you know, undercut their long-term investment in the downtown. We would buy the building at market price, so they would get their investment in this building back, mm-hmm. and make, you know.
Did you consider a rent-to-own sort of setup?
We didn't get to that point. I mean, I certainly, yes, that was something in our thinking, mm-hmm. absolutely. But even that, the proposed, when we did get. So we went from 1 year proposal, I proposed 3 years. We would then be 5 years old. If at 5 years old we haven't really figured out how to make the finances work and to have started a campaign and start to see the kinds of contributions that would put us in a place to buy the building, we would know in 5 years, mm-hmm. is this going to work or not? And I always thought in my mind that it was like 60-40 that we could succeed. I never said that, oh man, this is going to happen. It was always a question in my mind whether we could pull this off. But that's the kind of time frame that we needed to build the organization to do it. Right. And so after I proposed 3, they came back with a suggestion. I was thinking 10 years. Mm-hmm. But then that was just their lawyer didn't think that 10 years was a good idea. I'm not sure I did either. So that's sort of where we got to, going back and forth. And it kind of, you know, from there, it devolved into essentially 3 separate issues, and one overarching issue that only became clear to me later on, and that's the part that's where I start to just back away and wonder. And so,
what was that issue?
Well, I think. So the first issue, you know, you have very normal standard things that, you know, you as a nonprofit worker and then, you know, doing what you guys do, you have landlord-tenant issues. Mm-hmm. And then you have nonprofit major benefactor issues, mm-hmm. just tensions in terms of what's what. And then I would say, to a smaller extent, but it's out there, there was background chatter. People in a small community, people that maybe for whatever reason didn't want to see us succeed, so that there was some of those conversations. I'm not going to get into what that was, but I think that's out there, uh-huh. you know, and so we were just trying to push through and do our work. And so as those things began to swirl around, it just became harder to actually feel like we were on the same page. And so that's what it came to is is my, and maybe the owners, I was working to create one organization. Mm-hmm. They gave us the opportunity thinking we were creating a different organization.
Still a gallery.
Still a gallery.
Yeah.
But just a different kind of space, a different kind of gallery. And so while we think we're making great progress, we're solving problem A, they have in mind problem B. And
what's the different the different type of gallery?
So put it into radio terms. They thought we were trying to, that they were helping us create NPR. And we thought we were creating KRFB. And so you just had two different concepts of how you operate within the sphere. They thought they were creating something maybe more in line with, say, a museum or something like that. And we've always, whether we were working as the Pritchard or now as Moscow Contemporary, been very artist-centric, very just, what does the artist want to do? What are they? How can we help them create their vision for an exhibition or whatever it is?
Yeah, I remember. I noticed, you know, when they used to close down Main Street for Art Walk in June and so forth, there did seem to be like two types of art that you could see. You could see the edgy like stuff, or you could see the stuff that they're trying to sell for, you know, wealthy people to put on their living room walls and whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it would be some characterization of that. I might not put it exactly in those terms, but yeah, I mean, that's, and we've always thought about what we do as a nonprofit. We're not, you know, we're not here to sell work. We're not here to present artists who, you know, may or may not think about the sale of their work as their primary goal in having an exhibit. So, you know, it varies by artist, and we support both of those visions, but that's not, we're not making choices based on whether we think art can sell. That's just not part of the equation.
So how unexpected was the notice to vacate?
I mean, I guess it was fairly unexpected at the same time where those our conversations across different proposals for how the space might be rented or however, and the amount of friction that began to grow in that relationship. You know, yeah, I could see it coming.
Okay, so but the actual notice came December 9th.
Yeah.
Okay, and any ideas, what are your thoughts of the future, where you might go as a gallery in the future, and finding a place probably, especially downtown, with, this grand anyway, would be quite difficult, thinking of maybe downsizing or going outside of downtown, or what are your thoughts?
At this point, we're open to possibilities, and I think there are a number of avenues forward, some of which are pretty intriguing. How realistic or not, you know, we're just at the start of that process. We figured out how to deliver our exhibit, our education programs for after school art, and our animal dance program that just started last fall and is absolutely amazing. And so what we do in terms of exhibitions, are we doing pop-ups? Are we doing things, different spaces? You know, our goal was to buy this building. Mm-hmm. So if we're prepared to try and work towards buying this building, buying another building, okay. As you said, you know, this is one of the best exhibition spaces in the entire state of Idaho. You know, to get back to that point, that's going to take a lot. You know, the idea here was that we already had that part. Right. It was getting the rest of the organization in place to keep that going. So to imagine trying to do that in some other spaces, that's going to take a lot of work to get to that. So we have definitely, this is definitely a setback for the organization in trying to keep something like that alive. But if you talk about a small town of 25,000, 50,000 or less that has anything like this, it's almost non-existent. There are lots of small arts organizations out there. Mm-hmm. But with this kind of space, with our kind of exhibition record and ambitions and the extent of our programming, we're almost, you know, uncomparable across the entire United States.
Right.
So trying to get back to that, yeah, that's the goal.
Yeah, how does this fit in your mind with the concept of that Moscow, Idaho motto, Heart of the Arts?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we were counting on and continue to count on. I mean, that's what will keep us alive as an organization and give us another place to grow, is that is this community. It is what it, you know.
Right.
Pulls is more than just its motto.
Yeah. Now, I guess most people would be thinking anytime they hear news of something big downtown in Moscow, they're thinking it might have something to do with the culture war in this community. From what you're saying, it did seem like the owners, Root Forest LLC, were a supporter of the arts. And so maybe it, I mean, yeah, sure, there's the NPR versus KRFP analogy. But does this have anything to do with the culture war in this town?
Well, it would be impossible to separate us out of as cultural workers and what it is the galleries represented here on Main Street from that dynamic. But, you know, we never thought of it exactly that way. I mean, it was just artists are out there creating and producing, and if someone wants to tag the notion of war onto it, you know, that's for them to do. This is the culture. This is what is happening. And anyone who's trying to suggest that they're fighting against, you know, a billion artists out there producing, you know, they're you know, going up against windmills. So that was never, it's a nice notion. It sounds good as a catchphrase, but it means nothing. So this, in terms of this town, there'll be people that are cheering our demise.
And what do you think this space is going to be? Just some commercial establishment?
I have no idea. I have no idea who, you know, we've been told that there is an offer. I have no details whatsoever on who's making the offer, what their plans are. All I know is that, as stated in our notice to vacate, that that offer is contingent on there not being a tenant in place. So we've got to vacate so they can proceed with actually seeing whether this offer is going to go forward.
Okay. Supposedly we have a new gallery downtown that the University of Idaho is putting in the old police station. What are your thoughts about that space? It seems sort of small, and it's also maybe going to be more of a merch thing.
Yeah, I think you just got to wait and see.
Yeah.
I think there's real potential in that building. You know, if you go back to what it originally was as a dairy barn, my understanding is there was a huge space in there that the trucks backed into for them to load. So if they ripped it back out, maybe they can make a space that's quite intriguing. You know, they have the architectural expertise. Are they willing to invest what it would take to make it into a space equivalent to what they had? Yeah. Architects can pull off amazing things.
Yeah.
Well, we're just going to have to wait and see. And for now, it's because of the nature of that space or what they're calling their program there. You know, this is kind of very high-level whatever. Mm-hmm. This is not an artistic curatorial program that's being fully expressed. This is just that upper level, let's grasp some, you know, funding. They seem to have their primary target is alumni, as that would be expected. So, you know, we'll see where that goes. You know, I have further thoughts and ideas, but right now you got to see what happens there. You know, in terms of what we were doing here, I never felt threatened by that as
no.
Something. The way that our donations changed when we created Moscow Contemporary, we were pulling from a completely different population than we did when we were the university. So there was, you know, I never had any sense that was going to be a problem for us. And when they do bring on a real curatorial program there, I also was like, okay, if they actually start to do some really interesting things, bring it on. Let's have a little competition in that regard. More art is more art. That's what I said to City Hall. This would be great. I mean, we could have, you know, really build an artistic community here that, you know, has high functioning, highly active exhibition spaces with a rather substantial artist community. All that would do would grow. So that, you know, some of those things, yeah, that's still my intention, is get to the place where we're creating an interesting, challenging artistic environment that's very alive.
Uh-huh. Is there any way the city could help?
I've been looking at different examples of things that have developed. Missoula Art Museum began because they had a Carnegie Library that they'd ended up vacating, and it was sitting empty, and that's how that came about. It was a true city civic campaign. I don't see that they have exactly the capacity or the same kind of ethos just across the entire state. So it's hard to know what, if there's something there or not.
Right. It always gets political when you get a municipal government involved in the arts.
Yeah. I mean, that's back to the KRFP museum thing. You know, we're trying to do something that's an independent, artist-focused, artist-run organization. That's really where my passion lies. And yes, it is a very tenuous thing to pull off. I thought we had the chemistry here to do it. Uh-huh. And I still think in the community, but I thought in this location, we had the chemistry to make this work.
Okay, but now you're looking for another space, and I guess there are some nice spaces downtown, but on two levels where you have the stairs and all that, and the high ceilings, a few high ceiling places.
Yeah, you got to have high ceilings.
Yeah, so what programs are going to stop, which ones are going to continue, and... you can say hello if you want, and then we'll go with the question. Hi. What programs are going to continue, what are on hold, and what might stop?
So education programs are continuing at the 1912. We're looking at spaces and have already been offered spaces for some workshops and things that we otherwise do. And so I think that part's an easier piece of the puzzle to put together. When it comes to exhibitions and how else those might operate, we have the equipment, we have everything we need to do exhibitions. The space becomes a challenge, but there are spaces, and so are those temporary, or, you know, at the same time we are looking for a permanent new home. So we'll see. You know, as I said earlier, our long-term goal was to buy this building. Our goal will be to find a space long-term that we can buy to have a permanent home. So that hasn't really changed. So in the meantime, we'll see. You know, we have curatorial ideas. We have artists we want to work with. Do we switch to things that maybe are more ephemeral, projection-based, sound-based? Who knows exactly what it is that we start to do in the programming side. There are opportunities. And there are some interesting places in Moscow for us to do things. So that, for right now, that's our plan.
Okay, and I wanted to ask about the prison art project that was going to be in this space in January. Is that going to go somewhere else?
They're looking at spaces. They're talking to other venues. They may have something in the works. I'm not sure the current status of what that is. If we can figure out a way to support them, we will certainly do so. We have the capacity to print their announcement cards and do the certain things that help promote what it was exactly we would have done here. So if it might still come forward as brought to you by Moscow Contemporary, but we'll have to see, because when we did that first Prison Education Initiative show here a year ago, that was done really pretty quick, and so it was pretty small, contained to the first floor. They've been planning for this one. They've been knowing that they're producing work for an exhibit here. We were going to fill the entire gallery space. Mm-hmm. Well, there aren't that many spaces that have this much room that you can suddenly pivot to. They just don't exist. So what happens there? You know, the organizers of that have been put into a real pinch, and it's unfortunate and out of our hands. Whatever we can do to help them, we are trying to do.
Okay. Anything you want to say to sum up the situation, Moscow Contemporary so far, or thoughts about the future?
We're still here. Yeah. We still have a staff. We still have a board. We still have an organization. We still know that there is both a need and a desire for what it is we do in the community, and we look forward to building up our programs, exhibition side, and everything we can, and we will work towards that diligently.
Okay. Thank you very much, Roger Relly. That was an interview with Moscow Contemporary Director Roger Relly speaking Saturday afternoon at the gallery space at 414 South Main Street during the last hour of operation after their building owner declined to renew their lease and ordered them to vacate the space by the end of January. In other news, the current Moscow City Council was scheduled to hold a workshop today at 5 p.m. in which the council members would consider council assignments for 2024, including council president, council vice president, council committee assignments, and assignment of liaison roles with commissions. The current council is scheduled to hold its regular meeting tonight at 7 p.m. at City Hall, in which the council will take care of remaining business from the previous year, including mayor's appointments, reports from council members, and approval of the previous meeting's minutes. The city clerk will then administer the oath of office to newly elected council member Bryce Blankenship and to returning council members Drew Davis and Sandra Kelly, who are starting four-year terms. Councilmember Maureen Laughlin is leaving the council after one term. Laughlin did not run for re-election. The 2023 council will then adjourn, and the 2024 council will convene with Council Vice President Gina Taruccio presenting council organization for 2024. After that brief meeting, the council will adjourn for a reception honoring newly elected and outgoing council members. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area, it will be mostly cloudy tonight with a low of 32, 50% chance of precipitation tomorrow, slight chance of rain and snow before noon, then a chance of rain. Snow level 3,200 feet, otherwise cloudy, high near 40, little or no snow accumulation expected. Wednesday night, 60% chance of rain, mainly after 10 p.m., snow level 2,700 feet, cloudy, low 32. And on Thursday, 40% chance of precipitation, chance of rain and snow, mainly before 4 p.m., patchy fog before 10 a.m., snow level 3,000 feet, otherwise cloudy, high 38. New snow accumulation Thursday, less than half an inch possible. Also, up to an inch of snow possible Thursday night, and another half inch of new snow accumulation possible on Friday. Currently 36 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843, or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. I'm Lee Robartas. Flashpoints is up next, followed by Rude Awakening, a replay of the debut episode from September. Stay tuned for more KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by Hotchins Drug and Hobby of 307 South Main Street in Moscow. Hotchins features a pharmacy, educational toys, and hobbies. Hodgins also sells and services hearing aids. You can call Hodgins at 208-882-5536.
KRFP, Moscow.